Alaska Public Media's Every Little Bit recognizes people who go above and beyond to strengthen our community in Anchorage and South Central Alaska.
I think if someone wants to start a community event, they should just go for it.
I believe in serving your neighbor, love one another.
There's always something that you can do.
Wherever people meet one another's needs, all of us are enriched by that.
Do you know someone doing good in your community? Nominate them at alaskapublic.org/littlebit.
Hey Alaska, I'm Dr. Jay Butler, guest host today welcoming you to Line One, Your Health Connection. As we enter November, we're on the cusp of cold and flu season, and there are important steps you can take to protect yourself and your family. Among them, get enough rest, eat a healthy diet and maintain a good body weight, avoid cigarette smoke, drink alcohol in moderation if at all, wash your hands often with soap and water, or use an alcohol-based hand cleaner. But perhaps the most important thing you can do is getting your immunizations against influenza, COVID-19, and for some people, respiratory syncytial virus, or RSV, the latter being a particular viral troll for us here in Alaska. But some recommendations that have stood for years have recently been questioned by federal government officials, or even changed without explanation or presentation of new data that would justify these changes. These events have created confusion among patients and providers alike, leaving us wondering what is true, who should we trust, and what should we do. As an example, the current state of uncertainty and confusion, there have been nearly 1,700 measles cases in the U.S. thus far this year. That's the most in 34 years. The measles vaccination schedule that has been recommended for decades provides 97% protection against this most infectious of viruses. Yet in a recent Annenberg poll, nearly a quarter of U.S. adults believe U.S. Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. recommends the vaccine, a little more than a quarter believe he does not recommend it, and roughly half really can't tell. My guest today served as director of the Human Genome Project and went on to be the director of the National Institutes of Health during three presidential administrations from 2009 to 2021. He's received both the Presidential Medal of Freedom and the National Medal of Science. He has written extensively, including the New York Times bestseller, Language of God. For his most recent book, The Road to Wisdom, on Truth, Science, Faith, and Trust, he has appeared broadly on national media, ranging from the PBS NewsHour to The Late Show with Stephen Colbert. How can you top that? Of course, by joining Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media. If all that wasn't enough, he also rides a Harley, plays in a rock band, and killed them as a contestant on Not My Job on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Dr. Francis Collins, it's an honor to welcome you to Line One.
What an intro. My goodness. Hello there, Jay. It's nice to join you on Line One. And hello out there to Alaska. Nice to be able to chat with all of you also through this medium and looking forward to hearing questions that people might put forward.
Yes. And we do invite Alaskans to join the conversation. You can call us here in Anchorage at 907-550-8433 or toll free statewide at 1-888-353-5752. You can also email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. Francis, if I may call you that, I think we've had a professional relationship in the past, so I'm accustomed to the first name relationship.
I'm glad.
Yes. Francis, you've written that the four bedrock sources of wisdom our civilization has depended on for centuries are truth, science, faith, and trust. As an epidemiologist, an important part of methodology is case definitions. So let's start by defining these terms. So I guess the real softball question we lead off on is, what is truth?
Well, you asked the question, and those of us who are people of Christian faith are already remembering that that was a question posed to Jesus by Pontius Pilate hours before the crucifixion. And Jesus chose not to answer. There was no answer provided. So it would be pretty bold indeed for me to say, oh, I know the answer, because there's so much that we could talk about there in terms of what is truth. But maybe a few ground rules that I wouldn't think would be necessary to touch on, but these days, maybe they are. First of all, let's establish there is such a thing as objective truth. There are real facts upon which, for which evidence is overwhelming. The earth really does go around the sun and not the other way around. That's not an illusion. There may be a few of you out there that would say, well, no, wait a minute, maybe we're just all living in some computer simulation. I'm not in that category. I don't know how to take that anywhere interesting or useful. So let's say reality exists, and then truth exists about that reality. We know, for instance, that the earth, because we've seen it from people who went to the moon, is round. So if you're part of the Flat Earth Society, I'm going to argue that's not a good thing, because our society depends upon truth, depends upon collecting evidence, testing it, retesting it, and ultimately coming to a conclusion, yes, this is an established fact. And by the way, the fact doesn't care how you feel about it. So it's not okay to say, well, it might be true for you, but it's not true for me, if it's something like the earth going around the sun. Facts really are disinterested in your opinion. So that's one part of the definition that we ought to get to in terms of Pilate's question to Jesus and your question to me. What is truth? Well, first of all, there is such a thing. Yes, we make mistakes. We think we have established something, and it turns out, oh, there's new information here, and that isn't so established after all. But part of society's goal is to take things where there is uncertainty and try to collect more information, to build up our storehouse, our portfolio of things that we know to be true. And that's been really good for us. We are now, on the average, living to about 80 years old. 125 years ago, that was more like 40 years old. And that's largely based upon building up our storehouse of established facts about public health and medical research. And so that's a good thing. And we don't want to push aside the importance of continuing that activity just because we seem to be disagreeing about almost everything. We still want to be able to agree on things that are objectively true.
Okay. I thought about posing that question, trying to imitate Rod Steiger in the Franco Zaffirelli film, but he has a lot of pauses for drama that I think would just be dead air on the radio. So decided
can't
against,
do certain quotes on the radio, huh?
Decided against that. So where does emotion fit into our perception of what is true? And I think in particular in this day and age, I'm interested where fear might fit into that.
Yeah. Well, it fits in a big way. And I'm a scientist as well as a physician. And I didn't really pay as much attention as I probably should have to how important emotion can be, until COVID came along. And then it was so clear that we were having a seriously emotional experience. People were dying all around us in a terribly difficult circumstance. And it was not enough to simply put facts on the table and expect that they were going to be sufficient to cause people to accept them if they were also facing some really emotional and scary experiences with a lot of fear about what might be happening to them and their families. Philosophers have talked about this a lot. The philosopher scientist Descartes, the famous "I think, therefore I am," had this view that we're all rational actors. You give us information, we're going to make a rational decision. That was my view, but I was wrong. Philosopher David Hume came along a little later and kind of blew that out of the way and said, reason is a slave to the passions. Passions being the emotions, among other things. And if you think your reason is just so airtight that it's going to hang completely on facts and evidence, just throw a little passion in there and you'll see how quickly that can start to get shaken. I like Pascal's version of this a little better, maybe because Pascal was also a scientist and a mathematician and a person of faith. He said that the heart has reasons that reason knows not of. Yes. Okay. Again, your emotions, such things as fear, anxiety, love, all of those things have an influence on exactly how you take information on board and decide whether to own it or to push it off to the side. And I think right now, Jay, when we see such polarization in our country of the United States, but also in other parts of the world where people really have been aligning themselves with particular tribal groups because that's where they felt other people were of the same mindset. And a lot of that is emotional. A lot of it's fear, and there's anger in there. There's resentment, there's grievance, there's all this animosity. That really colors your ability to be able to decide what is true. If somebody tries to convince you of something, but they're part of that group over there that I don't think they're on the right track, and maybe they're even dangerous, I'm going to reject whatever it is they're telling me, even though it might be exactly what I need to hear and what I need to know about. So yes, emotion, passion, fear, they're all in there. And we should be working to be more aware of that so we don't get caught up in accepting information as verifiable when it actually wasn't. And social media is a great example of where those dangers can be quickly viral, where something that makes you angry or fearful spreads about 10 times faster than something that's just simple objective truth. And we've all been influenced by that in the course of the last few years in a way that isn't really good for us.
Yeah. And I think there's some generational issues there also. Older people, not as accustomed to social media. Just my observation is they seem to assume that it must be true. It's in a Times New Roman font, so it's it's true. Whereas I'm encouraged that I hear among some of the younger people a real skepticism of what they read. It doesn't mean that they're perfect consumers of social media, but I'm hoping that that initial impression plays out to be true going forward.
I hope you're right, but the skepticism sometimes spills over in a young person into just overall cynicism about, I don't believe any of this. And so when something does come along that's well validated and established, they're going to be skeptical of that too, just because that's the knee-jerk response to everything. And that's dangerous in a different way than being gullible and accepting everything that happens to pop up on your Facebook feed.
Well, let's move on then to our second definition. What is science? We hear a lot about following the science.
And yeah, we should probably drop that phrase because it's been used so many times in ways that really were anything but scientific, usually to try to browbeat somebody who is disagreeing with you that, okay, I'm the arbiter of science, and so I'm going to tell you follow the science, which means follow me. And some of the people saying that didn't really have the authority to do so. So what is science? Science is this, I would say, it's like a detective story. It's a wonderfully adventurous, noble human activity to try to understand how things work. Science, properly carried out, can discover things about nature, including about ourselves, that are breathtaking in their insight, in their even beauty, in terms of how complex and wonderful our universe is. And we get to explore it with science. So science is very much anchored on what we talked about a minute ago, that there is such a thing as objective truth, and that can be discovered if one applies rigorously the scientific method, where you basically, you come up with a hypothesis about how you think things work, and then you design an experiment to see whether that is true or not. And you have to come at this with full objectivity. You can't have a bias, like I know what the answer should be and I'm really attached to it. Although scientists sometimes have trouble with that because you are somebody who cares about your work. At the same time, the gold standard of science has to be skepticism about everything until it's been shown unequivocally. And then replicated by somebody else, then we should always have a little bit of like, oh, not sure about that. But over time, science gets a lot of stuff right. And we all depend on it every day. You walk in your house and you turn on the light switch. Well, that's science has developed the ability to provide that kind of human activity, just as if we don't even have to think about it. And certainly in terms of the science of the human body, We still have a lot to learn because it's such a complicated organism, especially when it gets to the brain. But there's stuff we know scientifically about the human body. We know there are 3.2 billion letters in your DNA code, and we even know what those letters are in individuals because we've been able to develop the scientific approach to read them out. We didn't know that 25 years ago, and we do now. And we will not have to go back to a place of ignorance where we don't know that. So science builds information as it moves along. And if properly conducted, it's the kind of evidence that one can be confident is true and legitimate and trustworthy. And if the folks who have spent their lives developing something and have had that appropriate skepticism will tell you, yes, this is a fact now that you can be sure of, that should mean a lot. And you shouldn't be shaken because somebody who has none of that background suddenly posts something on social media or makes a political speech saying they don't believe it anymore. That's, again, attacking truth is not a place where scientifically or societally we want to go. So I guess truth and science are kind of connected. Science is a way that you can discern truth about the natural world. We're coming to faith, which is a way to discover truth about things that science can't really help you with, like, why am I here anyway?
Yeah. So science is really the methodology of beginning to better perceive what is objectively true, what exists apart from us. Am I hearing you correctly?
You are hearing me correctly. Yes, apart from us, very important. Science discerns things that are true, whether we were here or not, or whether we like them or not. Obviously, if it's about our human species, well, we sort of have to be here to be able to do that study. But yes, the information that comes out of science is simply knowledge that has been established. It is not dependent on your opinion.
Well, we'd love to hear from you out there in the audience as well. Feel free to join the conversation by calling us locally in Anchorage, 907-550-8433, or toll-free statewide at 1-888-353-5752. You can also email us at lineone, that's L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at alaskapublic.org. So, when we think about this process of moving towards what is true, you've used the example of COVID already. Sometimes we have to make some leaps, and sometimes those leaps are in the wrong direction. One that I think I feel personally burned by was looking at the genetic relatedness between SARS-CoV-2 and SARS-CoV-1. SARS-CoV-1 appears to not be as transmissible as it turns out SARS-CoV-2 was. That was something certainly we tried to course correct in the course of the response to COVID-19, but it was hard because many people saw that as sort of waffling back and forth. And I think there's a long history of that in health. Let's see, 5 years ago, we were not supposed to feed peanuts to our kids till they were in college or something. Now we want to expose them to peanuts as early as and often as possible. How can the public and how can we as healthcare providers better communicate that degree of uncertainty and how to basically make decisions based on the science that is available?
Jay, it's a great question. And I think you're right to raise this as something we haven't done a very good job. I mean, I'm talking to myself here too, about explaining to the public when we are trying to offer up conclusions, particularly about people's health. Certainly, you mentioned the whole issue about SARS-CoV-1, which used to just be called SARS, but that was, remember that epidemic, which happened 23 years ago, which scared us a lot. And it got to Canada, for instance, and there were people who were getting sick and dying, and we thought it might be the big one. But it turned out that SARS was only really infectious from people who were quite sick. So it made it relatively more straightforward to identify who you needed to be sure was in some way isolated and not exposing themselves to other people who would then get sick too. When SARS-CoV-2, COVID, came along, being also a coronavirus, with early data being very sketchy, and frankly, the Chinese were not forthcoming in telling us what they knew, The assumption was that this would probably also be a circumstance where if you had it, you were going to be pretty sick. And so you wouldn't be just walking around or going to a PTA meeting. That turned out to be wrong, that with COVID, with SARS-CoV-2, people who had no symptoms at all could be super spreaders and were. And that's why we had to switch from the initial recommendation about don't worry about wearing a mask if you're feeling okay, to everybody needs to put on a mask if we're going to somehow flatten this curve and reduce the number of new infections, just as hospitals are becoming overwhelmed. So, Jay, it's too bad. This would have been a great moment if it wasn't such a crisis, or maybe even because it was such a crisis, to teach the story of science, even as it's happening in real time. Because I was in the middle of this. I was the NIH director. We learned about this virus on January 10th, 2020. We read out the letters of its genome code, and it's a coronavirus. And we started building the vaccine for that in 48 hours, but we didn't know a lot about what to expect from this virus. And we were kind of all along saying, well, I'm going to have a hypothesis and that this particular virus is going to behave in this way. And now let's look at the data. Oh, I was wrong. This was the scientific method happening 24 hours at a time sometimes. And it led to conclusions that were surprising to us. And I don't think we did a great job of explaining to the public why that meant that the public health recommendations were going to change over time, that we're going to say, you don't need a mask, and then you need a mask, that we're going to say, yes, it would be really good to get everybody tested, but then the testing wasn't available. All of that could have been handled better. And I think along the way, we lost some of the confidence of the public that the messages they were getting were things that they could trust. That, of course, was part of the problem. And then there were many other voices piling on with information that was demonstrably false that led people into even more confusing spaces. And I'm sorry to say some politicians joined in that fray. And we ended up in this incredibly tragic situation. This was a circumstance that our polarized communities should have been brought together. We were fighting a common enemy, the virus. And for maybe a month or two, we were kind of in that space of being together. And then all these other things began to break in, and it began to fracture our willingness to trust each other. And we moved off into our separate corners. And what could have been a great unifying moment instead seems to have led to even more polarization, more distrust.
Yeah. Well, I'd like to return to that topic of polarization later in the discussion. I think you've mentioned that reason is a slave to the passions, and that highlights, as you're touching on, what happened in January and February of 2020. The scientists also are subject to fear as they look at a virus and are unsure what may be coming at them and their families and their loved ones, as well as to the society as a whole.
Indeed.
So on that note, it's time we take a break, and we'll be back in a moment. This is Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media.
Hi, I'm Avery Elfelt, a reporter with the Alaska Desk. That's a joint reporting effort from Alaska Public Media, KHNS, where I work in Haines, and other public radio stations in Anchorage, Fairbanks, and the Aleutians. It allows us to connect you with the issues happening in communities all across the state. You can hear our stories during the morning news, on Alaska News Nightly, or online at alaskapublic.org. The Alaska Desk is only possible with the support of grants and listeners like you. Thank you.
Welcome back to Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media. This is Dr. Jay Butler, guest host for today, and my guest is former NIH Director Dr. Francis Collins. We're discussing the interplay between truth, science, faith, and trust. Francis, we've discussed truth and how there is such a thing as objective truth. That's the foundation for science, which is the methodology or a methodology to move us towards a better understanding of what is objectively true. Let's continue with our case definitions. It's been said that faith is believing in things you know ain't true. But I'm thinking you may have a better definition. What is faith?
I think that was Mark Twain. And maybe that's what some schoolboys and schoolgirls think.
Well, all brilliant quotes are either Mark Twain, Winston Churchill, or C.S. Lewis in my book. But anyway.
Not a bad trio. Frankly, that was something I would have agreed with when I was 20 years old. And then something happened. I became a Christian, to my great surprise, in my 20s. What is faith? Faith is the ability to explore and hope to find truth in areas that science is unable to comment on. Such questions as the big one, why is there something instead of nothing? How did the universe have a beginning out of nothing at the moment of the Big Bang? Why am I here? What happens after I die? What is the meaning of good and evil, and where does that come from? And why do I believe that I'm supposed to be good, and I even make up excuses when I find that I'm not? Those are questions that science, if it has any answers at all, they're pretty sketchy, and they require you to either dismiss them and say irrelevant, or to find some other approach. And that approach, in most people's experience, leads you to thinking about a creator to make it possible for this something instead of nothing to be here. And for many of us, a creator who ultimately emerges as not just a deist kind of God who made something happen at the Big Bang and then went off and did something else, but actually a creator who cares about us, this special creature with a big brain, the product of billions of years of evolution, who has this hunger to have answers to questions like, why is there good and evil, and why am I supposed to be a moral creature? So that's what faith is all about. When I was doing my own training in chemistry and physics before I went to medical school, I thought this was just a total waste of time to even talk about this, because if you couldn't measure it scientifically, why would you even want to spend a minute thinking about it? But going to medical school, sitting at the bedside of people whose lives were clearly under threat, and many of them were not going to survive for long, I had to wonder about why their faith in some instances seemed so powerful, important, and why mine seemed to be a totally unexplored area. And I got challenged by a patient of mine who simply asked me one afternoon, "Doctor, what do you believe?" And realized I didn't know. That's not a good thing. People listening to this particular program, has anybody asked you that question? What do you believe? And do you have a solid answer? Boy, I shouldn't. I decided I better do some exploring. And that exploring, to my surprise, instead of strengthening my atheism, which is what I thought it was going to do, led me to gradually realize that atheism was the least rational of the choices, and that belief in God was actually very compelling based on evidence. And then ultimately, the historic individual, Jesus Christ, came to my attention and solved a lot of other problems that I had about what to do about my own wickedness. So it was a two-year journey, but it brought me to a place of a different kind of truth, not a truth like mathematics. Some people are disappointed by that. Why doesn't God just give us the proof? Eugene Peterson, the wonderful translator of the Bible, said, "Well, I suppose you want God to give you something in mathematics, but how do you say I love you in algebra?"
So as you describe that, an experience comes to mind a number of years ago when grocery stores transitioned from the old style automatic doors where you stepped on a pad and it made the door open to motion sensors, and it was generally then a door that looked like a window that slid to the side. And I remember watching an older gentleman who had obviously never seen one of these doors before, and he was walking back and forth. He actually touched the window, and finally he walked in the right place and the door opened, and it was like the door into the mines of Moria had just opened. He looked amazed. He paused for a moment like he was waiting for the voice to say, enter and enjoy the bounty of Fred Meyer here. But the connection with that story is, does religion simply fill the blanks that are not yet filled in by science?
Well, that would be a God of the gaps kind of argument. And that's an important argument because over time, I think certain religions, including mine of Christianity, has tried to anchor their case on an area that we didn't know something about yet. A particular example would be the complexity of human beings. How could those possibly have come about except by God's a singular moment from the dust of creating humanity, and this idea that this might somehow have happened by natural processes through evolution, which I would also say was God's plan, didn't seem acceptable. So there was a God of the gaps there. Whenever we put in one of those, we have to look very carefully to make sure that's not going to be set aside by further advances in science. Augustine warned us about that back in 400 AD, saying, let's be careful. You don't put your faith in a situation. And he was particularly talking about how you interpret origins in the book of Genesis, that some new development comes along and makes you look foolish, because then you've done harm to the faith by attaching a particular narrow view to what is not a narrow description of why we're all here. So yes, you're right. God of the gaps are a problem. But again, are we going to find a scientific answer to why there's something instead of nothing? I don't know too many philosophers or scientists who are optimistic about that ever coming true. Nor do I think we'll find an answer to why it is the universe is so fine-tuned. People who haven't heard about this might be surprised to know. Those constants that determine how the universe behaves, like the speed of light and the gravitational constant and the strong and weak nuclear forces, those constants just have the value they have. You can't determine them from theory. But when you look at what they are and you imagine that they were off by just a little bit, like, you know, one part in a billion, the whole thing doesn't work anymore. You don't have any possibility of anything interesting, just some particles flying around. Nothing that you could consider by any means could give rise to intelligence. So it looks like the dials were set here. That's not going to go away. Now, the argument that has to be put forward by those who don't like that as a case for a creator who happens to be a mathematician and a physicist has to be that, well, there must be an infinite number of other parallel universes, and they have different values of those constants. And because we're here, we're the ones that won the lottery. And will you ever be able to observe those other universes? No, probably not. So where is the higher likelihood here of these choices? For me, it does come down to there's a creator behind this, and there's other arguments for that as well. And that creator wanted to have a universe that would be interesting, even to the point of our having this conversation, Jay. Yeah.
So are science and faith in conflict? You're best known as a man of science. You've just described yourself as a man of faith. Does that give you a little yin and yang conflict internally? Or tell us more.
It doesn't. It does not. And that surprises a lot of people. And it would have surprised me if you had tried to tell me at age 20 that science and faith could get along, because I saw them pretty much the way many people do, as locked in some sort of conflict that can never be resolved. Not at all. And it's not like I put my science and my faith worldviews off in separate corners and do everything possible to be sure they don't ever encounter each other on a Thursday afternoon. Not at all. When I'm in the laboratory, what am I doing? I am doing experiments to try to uncover truth about nature. But at the same time, I think nature is a gift from God. So in a way, I'm worshiping by understanding what the Creator has offered up. Are there conflicts that people have perceived? Oh, of course. Much of it often relates to interpretation of particular scriptures and were they intended to be literal? Was Genesis trying to say that everything was created 6,000 years ago in a series of 24-hour days? That's a very recent interpretation, mostly by conservative Christians in the United States. And going back to Augustine, I would have been appalled to imagine that that was being insisted upon as almost a litmus test for being a real believer, because the actual scriptures don't seem to require that in any particular way. So I have not, in now 47 years as a Christian, encountered a circumstance where I found an irreconcilable conflict between what I know as a hard-edged, rigorous scientist, show me your data, and what I know as somebody who reads the Bible almost every morning when I get up and sees that as an insight into the kind of wisdom that science can't necessarily provide, and a certain kind of truth that's a different sort. What you just have to be careful about if you're going to run into a conflict is, if you're asking a question, which kind of question is it? If it's about how nature works, that's a science question. Use science to find that answer. If it's a question about who is God, or what is love all about, or how should I live my life? That's a better one to go to your faith perspective, and you'll find more trustworthy answers. I found an organization called BioLogos. Jay, I think you know those folks. Wonderful people. Now, a couple million people are tapped into this. It's just biologos.org, as a place to have gracious dialogue about science and faith and how they can fit together. And lots of interesting conversations going on there, as well as meetings and webinars. So if people don't know about that and want to go deeper into that conversation, biologos.org would be a great place to go and look.
Okay. Earlier, you described the importance of skepticism in scientific method. Skepticism sometimes is viewed as doubt. Are doubt and faith in conflict? Are they polar opposites?
Not at all. I'm fond of Paul Tillich's very short statement that doubt is not the opposite of faith. It's an element of faith. My own faith experience often encounters circumstances where I have doubts about what exactly was meant by that particular verse in scripture, or that story from the Old Testament, or some other concept that I realize I have only superficially examined. And those can be a little unsettling, but they're always an opportunity to dig a little deeper. And I think my faith grows because of doubt. It doesn't shrink, it grows, because doubt is a chance to see where are the places that you still have work to do. And I worry about some implications in some churches that it's not okay to voice doubts. That somehow just ruled out of order in a Sunday school or in a conversation with a pastor. Not at all. Those are the moments where you can really start to grow. You can get new insights. You can understand something about yourself and about God that wouldn't have happened if you hadn't been willing to put those doubts into words and wrestle with them.
Okay. Thank you. And we have a question by email from Chuck. Good morning. Loving the content this morning. Although I'm having difficulty with Francis's definition of faith, particularly the use of the ability, quote unquote, to ask the big questions. I certainly have the ability to ask these questions, as well as the ability to come to different findings. Might seem petty and small, but it struck me as a way that seemed a slight demeaning. Thank you for the show, and would you care to comment?
Well, Chuck, thank you for posing that. I will confess that that definition of faith was something that I just sort of rattled off. If I had to actually write an essay about it, I would have been a lot more careful, I think, about exactly the words chosen. And I certainly wouldn't want to put anything out there that sounded demeaning of alternative ways that people try to answer those questions. I guess I was trying to get across this, and we were just talking about this a minute ago, this opportunity that faith provides to address questions that science can't help you with. And that if you don't have that faith perspective as part of your agenda, you're really limiting yourself. It's almost like you have an impoverished sort of life philosophy. If only things that you can measure because they're part of nature are worth pursuing, that leaves out an awful lot. It certainly leaves out God. It leaves out in my mind, beauty in a certain way, because a lot of what I experience in terms of beauty, both in terms of what I see in nature and what sometimes I see in the laboratory, it touches me in some way that doesn't really make entire materialistic sense, and yet it completely fits with my view as a person of faith. So that's a bit of a ramble to what was probably a somewhat inarticulate definition. So thank you for raising the question.
It's kind of like the scientific method. We continue to ask questions and hopefully we refine what we say, and also yes. Sometimes say we didn't say that right, or maybe even we were wrong. So I think that was a great question and a fabulous answer. So it's time for us to take one more quick break, but don't go away. We'll be back in a minute with more Line 1 Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media with our guest, Dr. Frances Collins.
I'm Shelby Herbert, a reporter with the Alaska Desk. That's a joint reporting effort from Alaska Public Media and KUAC, where I work in Fairbanks, and other public radio stations in Anchorage, Haines, and the Aleutians. It allows us to connect you with the issues happening in communities all across the state. You can hear our stories during the morning news, Alaska News Nightly, or online at alaskapublic.org. The Alaska Desk is only possible with the support of grants and listeners like you. Thank you.
Welcome back to the third period of Line 1, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media. I'm your guest host today, Dr. Jay Butler, and we're talking with former longtime NIH Director Dr. Frances Collins about truth, science, faith, and trust, plagiarizing the subtitle of Dr. Collins' recent book, The Road to Wisdom. So, Dr. Collins, we've touched on polarization and the challenge that has been in health policy over the past few years. Thinking back a longer time, over the past quarter century, 9/11 generally seemed to unify us as a nation. Mm-hmm. COVID, after that first couple of months, seemed to polarize us and polarize us to a degree far beyond any disagreements about foreign policy following 9/11. Looking at the COVID vaccine uptake data, it appears that it still polarizes us. Why do you think that is, and how do we go forward?
Well, it's a great heartbreak that that is, in fact, irrefutably the case, that we are more polarized now than almost anybody can recall who wasn't around right before the Civil War, and I don't think any of us were. So we've somehow, over the course of time, and it didn't start with COVID, it had been building up over the course of maybe a few decades, of becoming increasingly of a mindset that if people don't agree with you, they're not just misguided. They're not just people that, well, we ought to have a conversation. They might be actually people who are evil and dangerous. And that mindset has infected more and more of our public discourse and has been, I'm sorry to say, greatly worsened by the way in which our politics has become more and more animosity laden and full of grievances and full of accusations. And the opportunity to actually discuss something and try to come to some compromise is now seen as some form of weakness. So COVID arrived already in the context of that kind of dynamic. And yes, for the first couple of months, it seemed to be reversing it in the way that one might have hoped, with people being willing to make sacrifices in order to try to save lives. When we saw those trucks pulling up to the morgue because the morgue didn't have enough room for the dead bodies, we all wanted to do something. But as time went on, as the fear continued, as messages about public health sometimes didn't land in a way that people could completely see why they were being asked to do this, where closures of businesses and schools seemed to be going on longer in some places than others, and why was that? And a whole lot of misinformation began to pile into the public consciousness coming from social media, from various other news sources, and from politics. People began to really get very confused about who to trust and who to believe. And a lot of decisions got made that were tragic. And I got to say, COVID, the response to COVID in terms of the development of the vaccine was an amazing enterprise. In the Trump administration, under Operation Warp Speed, something that had never been done before. a vaccine developed in 11 months, shown in a rigorous phase 3 trial to be 95% effective with very limited, if any, side effects. It was the most significant scientific achievement that we've been able to claim to help humanity in all the time that we've been keeping records. It should have been this moment for this sudden rush of public trust and enthusiasm that science has come to the rescue. But instead, 50 million people didn't believe it, didn't trust it, said, no, thank you. I don't want that vaccine, because they'd heard all these other things about maybe it's got a chip in it, or maybe it's going to make you infertile, or maybe a lot of people are dying from this that we're not hearing about. All of those were not true, but they found their way into people's minds, and they were further enhanced by which tribe you happened to be in, and whether that was a group that trusted the science they were hearing about or not. And the saddest part of this, Jay, which still just breaks my heart, is that 234,000 Americans died between July of 2021 and spring of 22, at a point where anybody who wanted a vaccine could get it. 234,000 people said no, and they're in graveyards. That's a fact. That's not somebody's opinion. That's an established fact. What? How could that have happened in our highly advanced, technologically sophisticated country, that something of that sort could still come to pass? That just tells you how severe our current culture problems are, our polarization, our clash of unwillingness to sit down and talk to each other.
Well, I want to return to that topic of polarization and what we can do about it in just a moment. But we have a question from Pablo that's going to pull us back to the questions around faith and how that relates to science. Okay. Pablo says, you explained how faith helps to answer questions which science struggles with, like the fine-tuned universe, etc. But why Christianity? Why did these uncertainties push you to accept one definition of God? This seems like a conflict to me. Do you believe other faiths are wrong?
Great question. And I struggled a lot myself as I began to recognize there was something here worth exploring. Well, which faith should I try to explore? And I read a lot about all of the world's religions, the ones that are most widely practiced, and recognized they have an awful lot in common. They all believe in the golden rule in various versions. They all believe in a God who cares about us. But I was looking for some way to try to size up where would that fit with my own sense of who I was. And I'll be honest with you, I was, as I began to be aware of the reality that God exists and that God cares about humans, I also saw this as a reason for the moral law, that this must be something that God has placed in my heart about being a good person if I can. And I also was aware that I was failing at that. And this is when I met the person of Jesus, who was different than what I saw in any other faith. And actually, suddenly it made sense to me, something that I had never understood, why Jesus died on the cross. That was for me. That was to make me right with God in a way that I couldn't do myself. That was it. That suddenly all fell together. And I also found out that the evidence for Jesus' life and death and resurrection was surprisingly solid historically. This was not some myth. This was something that really happened. And I couldn't unread that. So I became a Christian at 27, but I in no way want to say that other faiths don't have an enormous amount of truth to offer. Everybody should do their own search, as I did.
Well, I'll avoid the temptation here to ask you, as former director of the Human Genome Project, about the DNA of Jesus, but I want to thank Pablo for asking a tougher question than I've posed so far today. I would like to return to this issue of polarization and what we can do about it. You've been a very public and active member of a group called Braver Angels. I was wondering if you might want to tell us all a little more about that. I've been interested in this group myself. I've discovered that there is no chapter in Alaska. So here's a shout out to everyone in Alaska. Perhaps someone would like to take the lead in establishing that chapter.
Oh, if this conversation could result in that, that would be fantastic. So yeah, I investigated Braver Angels after I stepped down as the NIH director. Again, grieving about what I saw in the aftermath of COVID, about how polarization was not just leading to unpleasant conversation, it was leading to people losing their lives. Braver Angels was founded in 2017. It was a response to what was seen as this increasing polarization and a desire to try to put together a framework, an environment where that could be faced up to. By bringing together people who are on the opposite sides of a contentious issue in a moderated situation and having them not just shout at each other, but speak to each other and listen, critically listen. So if you're in a Braver Angels session, as I have been, many of them, most of mine have been about public health, as you might guess, the people on one side say what their view is, and they can be very blunt, but there are no personal attacks here. And the people on the other side have to listen. They have to listen so well that they say, okay, here's what I heard you say, and repeat back to them. And the other group has to say, yes, that's what I said. And then you switch roles. We don't do a lot of that anymore. This is like marriage counseling, except for the whole country. And I think that's what we need at the moment. And then after you've got those things on the table, then you can start to have a conversation, because by then you've really begun to understand, oh, that other person with that other opinion, you know, I can kind of see where they're coming from because I really heard them this time describing their basis for that opinion. So I can ask a question about that. They can ask me a question. And sometimes, almost all the time, in fact, somebody will then say, you know, I think from this conversation, I'm aware there's some things I've been doing about this issue that have not been helpful that I probably should stop doing. There's information that I've been sharing with other people that maybe isn't really true, but it just made me mad. And so I felt I should. And then everybody starts to become more honest. And at the end of a session like this, invariably, people go, you know, I don't think we're that far apart. Because down there underneath all of this, we still all believe in things like faith and freedom and family and love and beauty and goodness. And those foundations aren't gone. We've just piled all this other stuff on top. And Braver Angels is a really good way to strip away all of that and find that common ground. So yeah, there's more than 100 chapters across the country. I'm sorry there's not one so far in Alaska, but there should be. So if you're interested, braverangels.org, you can find out what they have going right now and how to start your own chapter.
Yes. And if someone knows of a Braver Angels chapter in Alaska, I will stand down on that. That's part of our scientific method. But please let me know. I'd be very interested in knowing that. So thinking about the future of public health. One of the things I find encouraging is that, you know, the schools of public health, everybody hasn't dropped out, even as professionals are retiring. On the Colbert Show this past July, you talked about the brain drain from healthcare, from biomedical research, from public health. In our last, it looks like we have about 4 minutes here. What is your advice to young people who are going into those areas today?
Well, it's this, that there's never been a more exciting time to be engaged in public health and in medical research. The progress that's possible now is just exponentially advancing. We have the opportunity to sort out things like how the human brain works. There's a big project on that that's beginning to yield up some really interesting insights about how those circuits in your brain do what they do and how they can get off kilter in places like Alzheimer's or Parkinson's or schizophrenia or autism. So this is the season, the generation that is going to have some of the most exciting scientific opportunities that we could ever imagine. So that would be the number one positive about it. It is true that right now we're going through a tough time, that the support for medical research in the United States has been under attack in this year of 2025, with cuts in budgets, with grants that are being terminated, oftentimes for unclear reasons, with universities that are back on their heels with a lot of attacks about whether they are in fact objective conveyors of truth. And that's resulted in termination of research projects on things like cancer and Alzheimer's disease, which doesn't seem like the right response if what we're worried about is trying to make America more successful. So it is a little bit of a scary time, and there are certainly young scientists looking at this who are beginning to wonder whether the United States is going to support their dreams or whether they need to look elsewhere. I know some of those young people. I think we have to be clear that this is a noble activity, that public health and medical research, we're saving lives. That's the whole goal. That's why people do this. They're not self-interested to become rich. They would like to contribute something to try to make people's lives better. And we need to support that in a way that we have pretty much without a lot of debate in the past. But right now, everything seems to be a little up in the air. We will get through this. But one of the things I'm trying to do right now, Jay, is to try to put together a bank of stories of people whose lives have been saved because of medical research. People with cystic fibrosis who, instead of planning for a funeral, are planning for retirement. People with sickle cell disease who are being cured by gene therapy. People with stage four cancers who, in one of these trials on immunotherapy, oh my gosh, it didn't just sort of work. I seem to be cured. This is happening. But I'm not sure those voices have gotten out there as much as they might, or that people realize that this doesn't come about just by dropping from the trees. It's years and years of hard work, much of it supported by the federal government, that makes these successes happen. And we don't want to do harm to that.
Yeah. We have barely a minute. We have a question from Johnny. Here's a medical question for you. As we've talked about the just miraculous cures during our lifetimes that we've seen of some of these previously incurable diseases, but it's specifically addressed to you, Francis. What is the best scientific recommendation for getting COVID vaccine this fall if you're a younger person, younger than 50, without any known underlying health conditions?
Without any conditions, obviously your risk, if you get COVID again, which you well might because it's still out there, your risk of getting really seriously ill or dying is pretty low. If you happen to be a young person who's a male, then there is this risk of myocarditis, about 1 in 10,000, that needs to be factored in there. So that might be a slightly significant thing to think about. But for the most part, the vaccines are incredibly safe. So certainly for most of us, I would say, although it's not currently as clear coming from the federal government, that if you have the opportunity to get a booster and COVID is still around, well, why not?
Yeah. Great. Thank you. That's all the time we have today on Line One, Your Health Connection. My sincere thanks to our guest, Dr. Francis Collins, and to all of you who joined us today. Better Than Strava kudos to our sound engineer, Crystal Hyde, and to producer, Madeline Rose. Big shout out to Dr. Ann Zink for giving up one of her shows and letting me get back in the saddle again. This is Dr. Jay Butler wishing you a healthy life informed. This is Alaska Public Media.
Line One is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Learn more about Line One and listen online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.